This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty. Back in 2012, I had the privilege of moderating my first panel discussion when I participated in the C.S. Lewis Foundation retreat for that year, which was held in Texas. As noted with a few other podcasts, since moving where my audio files are hosted, I hadn't shared this show since then. The theme of the retreat related to The Great Divorce, one of Lewis's fictional works, but a variety of questions were fielded by the panel. The following is the first 30 minutes of that panel discussion. The last half hour will be shared in a separate podcast. And there's a special treat in store at the very beginning where you get to hear C.S. Lewis himself doing the introduction to The Great Divorce. Guests who will be introducing themselves shortly are Joseph Pierce, Lou Marcos, Diana Glier, Andrew Lazo, and Doug Jackson. My name is William O'Flaherty. It's a pleasure to be here as the moderator and have the opportunity to do a couple sessions earlier, host a group, and to do a C.S. Lewis 101 with Andrew. He did two sessions. I got to do one. Wanted to start out, very special guest. This is a two-minute clip in its entirety of someone that we all know and love.
This is the introduction to C.S. Lewis's imaginative book, The Great Divorce, as he read it preceding a dramatic interpretation of the work on the BBC. This reading is based almost verbatim on the preface to the book and was recorded on February 27, 1948. I now present C.S. Lewis.
Blake wrote The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. If I've written of their divorce, this is not because I think myself a fit antagonist for so great a genius, nor even because I feel at all sure that I knew what he meant. But in some sense or other, people are always trying to make that marriage. That is because they think that reality never presents us with an absolutely unavoidable either-or. They think that some way of embracing both alternatives, both good and evil, can always be found, without any final and total rejection of anything we want to keep. I think they're wrong. Even on the biological level, life is not like a river, but like a tree. It doesn't move towards unity, but away from it. And creatures grow further apart as they increase in perfection. Good, as it ripens, gets more different, not only from evil, but from other good. If we insist on keeping hell, or even earth, we shall not see heaven. If we accept heaven, we shall not be able to retain even the smallest and most intimate souvenirs from hell. I believe, to be sure, that any man who reaches heaven will find that what he abandoned has not been lost. But we must not try to anticipate that retrospective vision. There's one more thing to be said about this program. I beg listeners to remember that it is a fantasy. It's not even a guess or a speculation about what may actually be waiting for us. The last thing I want to do is to arouse factual curiosity about the details of the afterworld.
C.S. Lewis himself. Now, unfortunately, and maybe someone on the panel, this wasn't an intended first kickoff question, but we actually do want to do introductions so everyone knows who our panel is. From what I know, what followed after that was not recorded, the actual drama itself.
No.
So, yeah, it was not done. Okay. Well, let me maybe have the panel themselves tell us about who they are. They are sharing mics, so feel free to adjust as necessary. We will start to my immediate left. I think everyone knows they've heard you here, but our main speaker, tell us who you are.
I'm Joseph Pierce. I'm a visiting fellow and a writing residence at Thomas More College in New Hampshire and other things.
My name is Louis Marcos, and I'm a professor of English and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. And I'll mention something now because I forgot to tell my little session there. If you go to my webpage, loumarcos.com, I have my first blog. Many people have been trying to get me to do that. It's called A to Z with C.S. Lewis. And every week there's a 600-word essay about it. And see, I'm an English professor. I don't believe in just writing off the top of my head. So I spent all summer writing it. So each one is a 600-word essay, and of course it's free on there. So, but I was encouraged by people over here. Get a blog! So I finally did it.
My name is Diana Glyer. I teach English at Azusa Pacific University in Southern California, and I'm Sierra's mom.
My name is Andrew Lazo. I teach English and a C.S. Lewis elective at Houston Christian High School, and do some writing and scholarship on Lewis. Been traveling and speaking with the foundation. This is my 9th year here at Camp Allen, and the 10th year of the retreat. And I'm very excited to tell you that there's a really interesting discovery about the chronology of Lewis's life coming forth in 7. I transcribed an unpublished manuscript over the summer, and So January of next year, you can check out the journal 7 from the Wade Center, and more to come.
I'm Doug Jackson. I'm the assistant professor of spiritual formation for Logsdon Seminary at their Extension campus in Corpus Christi.
All right, didn't do much of a formal introduction. I'm William O'Flaherty. I do C.S. Lewis Minute, and then I grouped some of my various different other things. I do an interview show. Some of these up here have been on my show or will be. And that is centralized through EssentialCSLewis.com. All right, well, now I was going to maybe do Lewis in Jeopardy and have our panel prove their worthiness. I'm going to do a slight variation. We will see, and we have no buzzer in front of everyone, so I'm going to keep a watchful eye on who raises their hand first. We were going to have them jump up, but they're behind a table, and they could get messy. So there's just a single question for the Lewis in Jeopardy, and the one who answers it the fastest will be the star of the panel, I guess. On the 10th of November, on this date, sometime in 1940, we need the date. What series began, and where did it begin?
I'm guessing Screw Tape Letters in the Garden.
Oh, Lou, you were so promising. You were really built up as you were going to get, you know, any question if I did have multiple questions. But it's a save here. Let me just do a plug. In addition to getting his week by week, the blog, the A to Z, you can get it in a single ebook now for, I think, a mere 99 cents.
Well, that's right.
And I do have that. Who has the internet?
No.
What series began on this date, November the 10th,
Andrew
sometime in the 1940s? He's a lifeline.
Actually, plugging a friend, if you go to joelheck.com,
yes.
You will find his, you know, 7,375-page PDF document available for free download called Chronologically Lewis. This amazing, amazing man has not only written Irrigating Deserts, Lewis on Education. He's been with us several times in the past. He has gone through every single letter Lewis has written, all of the biographies, all of the peripheral letters, and then compiled them into a chronology.
Wonderful.
375 pages.
So did you say all that so you could find the answer?
I was stalling.
Yes.
I've got a second guess. I don't think it's too early, though. I'm thinking 41 minutes.
Was it Broadcast Talks?
Oh, gee, guys. How about let's go with the obvious? The theme of our...
He began writing The Great Divorce.
The Great Divorce.
The Great Divorce was begun on this day in 1944. Okay, to save yourself, what was the original title? Who would like to... Yes, Andrew.
Hugo's Home.
No. Hugo's Home.
Hugo's Home, or The Grand Divorce, originally. If you go to the Wade Center, you can see those originals.
It is a great joke. Hugo Dyson was the guy who single-handedly destroyed the Inklings. This guy was hilarious. He'd go into to the bookstore and say, I need a secondhand copy of Shakespeare. Well, we don't have them. We'll just rub it on the floor and sell it to me as shop-worn then. It was quite a wit. He sees somebody going up the steps of the Sheldonian, and he barks his shins, and he says, my dear lad, don't do that. It hurts you, and it distresses me. And so if The Great Divorce is about effectively hell, and it was called Who Goes Home, the Inklings affectionately referred to it as Hugo's Home.
Should I go with a bonus super trivia? The Great Divorce has 14 chapters, but the original weekly series was how many?
13.
No.
I was told there'd be no math on the panel.
Oh, yeah, this is the math.
Do I need to go? Couldn't add a column of numbers, our friend Jack Lew.
23. There were 23 installments, yes. Yes, it was broken up differently. But anyway, great book. Okay. We don't necessarily have to talk about The Great Divorce. I've got some Kickstarter questions, but our lovely, what was your name? Crystal. Crystal will be roaming around, and she will take a question. I want to get some more, a general one, kind of out, so we can see if any on the panel would like to answer it, or all, as a Kickstarter question, and then we'll let the audience have a shot here. I've got others if we need those. What is the most surprising or fascinating thing about Lewis, or surprising or fascinating thing that you found others maybe don't necessarily know about Lewis? What would you say that would be? If there's anything come to mind in particular, the most surprising or fascinating thing? I could hit a range of aspects.
Why do I get to go first?
I'll go first. Some time ago, I was really surprised to discover how much Lewis hated writing letters. And when I think about the things I have to learn from C.S. Lewis, one of the things that really moves me deeply is understanding how seriously he took his responsibility to answer the letters that came to him. He hated writing letters so much he sometimes wished that Christmas wouldn't come, because he didn't like the increase in mail that he got around the holidays. And yet, daily, faithfully, he answered every letter that was sent to him. And he did it as a spiritual discipline and as an offering unto the Lord. He did it because he believed that God had given him an opportunity to do some small good in simply responding to the letters that he received. And I think about all of the great accomplishments of Lewis's life. I don't know that there's any more noble or more inspiring for me than the fact that he got up early each day to simply answer the letters that he received.
As I think probably almost everybody on the panel has heard from him, Walter Hooper loves to tell the story that Jack's motto was, when in doubt, give more. And whether he, when he was in doubt as to whether a letter should be answered, he went ahead and answered it. It's 50,000 letters, Walter estimates. 3,800 pages is the complete collected letters. And when people ask me what my favorite Lewis book is, I usually will say Collected Letters, Volume 3. If you open it, you will find yourself on the other side of the wardrobe in about 5 or 6 hours, having fallen in. Doug Gresham also answers email in the order he receives in honor of his stepfather, C.S. Lewis. And one of the things that I heard from him once was that the characteristic sound of Lewis that all of the biographers miss was the characteristic sound of laughter. He was laughing all the time and enjoyed a great hearty laugh. I love the theology and I love all of the implications and the humility, but I think that, and we've been talking a bit about laughter, you know, amongst some of us, it's a real sign of hope. This cheerful insecurity is how he said we should live life. And when he came close to his death, he said to Mary Willis Shelburne in Letters to an American Lady, you know, the train is about to leave the station. It's all rather solemn fun, isn't it?
One thing I learned I like, as you can imagine, I'm a big reader, always reading books and magazines, but I've always hated the newspaper. I've always thought reading the newspaper is a waste of time. And I found out Lewis felt the same way, so that made me feel good. I think you all know, of course, that Lewis gave about half of his income away, and what really impressed me was that, you know, he did it anonymously. And I learned a story recently that some of you may not have heard this story, so I'll share this one that I thought was wonderful. Gets to Lewis's heart. Apparently, one day he was walking down the street, and he saw a beggar on the street, and he wanted some money, and so he gave him some money. And his friend said, "Why are you giving money to that bum? He's just going to use it on drink." And Lewis's answer was, "Well, if I kept it, I would use it on drink." So, I thought that was Lewis, and at Baptist school, it's great.
My most pleasant surprise about C.S. Lewis was that story from Lou Marcus.
You know, I should tell you quickly where I learned that from. You remember the movie The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Well, in typical nasty Hollywood fashion, first they put out the DVD, then they put out a special edition, then they put out a super special edition to steal all your money. But it is worth getting the four DVD collection. Mm-hmm. Because the four DVD collection includes an hour and 15-minute documentary on the Chronicles of Narnia made by the two people in Disney that are Christians, and it is amazingly good. And that's where I learned that story.
It's called C.S. Lewis, Dreamer of Narnia. And those of you who were with us in San Diego saw those folks. They were our guests at Bag End Cafe. They were there.
You mean the ones that made it?
The ones that made it. And they talked about doing it quickly and under a shoestring. That quote was actually from Walter Hooper.
That's where I heard it.
Yeah, he actually heard it.
Anything else from the panel? Or it's fine if there's not, if you had something.
This doesn't surprise me anymore, as I've been familiar with it for some time, but I love surprising my Baptist tribe with it. The only thing, as you probably all know, holding up Lewis's full canonization as an evangelical saint was that he smoked and drank. And I love the story about, I think it was Walter Hooper who asked Bob Jones Sr., the old man, the founder of Bob Jones University, the great, very fundamentalist school, what do you think of C.S. Lewis? And his reply was, that man smokes, and that man drinks. But I believe that man is a Christian. It's a marvelous accomplishment on Lewis and Bob Jones' part.
Smoking and drinking fully qualifies him as a saint in my church, the Episcopal Church. If you don't believe me, let me read you this from the lectionary, The Lessons Appointed for the Lesser Feasts, for the Feast of C.S. Lewis. There's a collect for November 22nd for the birthday or the anniversary of the death of C.S. Lewis on the same day as John F. Kennedy, which surprises some folks as well. O God of searing truth and surpassing beauty, we give you thanks for Clive Staples Lewis, whose sanctified imagination lights fires of faith in young and old alike. Surprise us also with your joy, and draw us into that new and abundant life which is ours in Christ Jesus, who lives and reigns with you and the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen. Amen.
There was a mention of C.S. Lewis letters. I don't know, and still in the bookstore, if all three volumes were originally there, but if you are intimidated by all three volumes, though encourage you to consider them, there is a shorter one that was compiled by Paul Ford. Yours, Jack. Just simply yours, Jack, as if you were signing a letter. So that is out there. That is a single volume that has, you might say, the best of. Just a side note there. Who would like to ask the panel a question?
Well, it's kind of a two-part question. I'm just wondering, did Lewis write anything on the end times, and did he write anything on the Jews? And what was his take on the Jewish people?
I'll ask after the first one. I know all five of us could. But people ask me, what do I recommend as the best book to read on the end times or on the apocalypse? I always say that the most profound theology I've read by anybody on the end times are 30 pages of The Last Battle from the Chronicles of Narnia. And that's what's absolutely astonishing about C.S. Lewis. There's something really profound, deeper than anything from any theologian that I've read, and he does it within a children's story. That's a great gift, to be able to put complex, difficult theological points in a language that children can enjoy and that we can understand.
The primary text about the Jewish people, you're going to want to go to two things. One will be reflections on the Psalms, although there, as elsewhere, he recommends himself as an amateur and nothing more. It's worth also considering his preface to Joy Davidman's Smoke on the Mountain, her commentary on the Ten Commandments. But in terms of a specific treatment of the Jews, that's about as close as I'd get.
Yeah.
I mean, just again, you know, with the last battle, I mean, the way he shows that the dwarves in the stable at the end, in a sense, they're the chosen people. And yet they have blinded themselves like the Pharisees. And then you've got, you know, Emeth, who is from outside, who comes into the fold. And so I think you're right about the last battle, especially when Tash and Aslan become Tashlan. And when everything is true, then nothing is true. I think you're right. It really is the best.
This question came to me yesterday when you were after your talk. I was wondering if you all would speak on what you think in the Great Divorce is the relationship between the people who are coming on the bus and the people who are there, meaning who are these people meeting? I know that the mother wants to see her son and is not able to do that unless she gives up the love of her son that way. But who do you think C.S. Lewis thought we would meet? Or
Mary, I'm going to start on that. I'll take the liberty and do that. To some extent, what strikes me as I read that book is it's the last person you wanted to see. Not invariably, but very often. Becky keeps a list of people who will meet my bus. And it's an encouragement to me to reconcile now. Die before you die. There is no time afterwards. But I really think that's pretty profound. The thing from which I would not divorce myself may have been resentment or a bad relationship. And I can't take that into heaven. I can't smuggle that in. I have to meet it on the outskirts of deep heaven.
And let me, if you'll forbear me to correct you, I do not think that she wants to meet her son. She wants to meet herself. And ultimately, the choice that everybody makes is myself or anything else. Start loving anything outside yourself. Even that is a beginning in the right direction. She doesn't want her son. She wants her image of her son. This book actually really helped me get over kind of a personal idolatry towards Lewis. My first night in England, Stan threw my bag in the back of the car and took me to the kilns to spend the night. And never was there a man more prepared for idolatry in something more like a shrine. And I had Kleenex in the pocket of my coat. I was ready to be deeply moved and couldn't find him anywhere. And I got up in the morning and walked over, shot over, looking for him everywhere, trying to feel emotion. I stayed in the room where he shuffled off the mortal coil, and I pumped myself up, and it was useless. And as I was walking towards the pond a second time with my camera this time, I didn't hear a voice, but if I had, it would have said, "Why are you looking for the living among the dead?" And I realized that I didn't need him. It would be a great discourtesy and ungratitude to make him come down from high heaven where he truly would rather have been. I don't need him to come to me. He's alive in my books, or in his books. He's alive when I write. He's alive when we gather and talk about him. He's alive even when we have mealtime conversations that aren't about him, but because of the life that he gives us. And look at this full room. And so he helped me over that idolatry a little. I didn't really want Jack. I wanted to say that I had met him there.
I guess the one thing to add is if you're thinking particularly about will we see our friends and family in heaven, thinking about a lot of the new Life After Life books that have come out, I mean, this is fiction, but in The Last Battle, when they get up there, it's like a cast party. Now, you know, I don't know if that's Lewis' theology per se, but everybody is there, and of course their parents are on the other side, and they see everybody. So, again, that's fiction, but I think Lewis certainly hoped that we would recognize our friends and relatives, that it was fellowship.
Someone said a great shorthand definition of heaven is Narnia and England. Works for me.
Not necessarily in that order.
You don't think there's better beer in Narnia, friend?
Let me just add a quick side note. I have an essay by Dr. Donald Williams, and he wrote in terms of some of the issues about the doctrine, and since this is a supposal which was addressed, but he shares a quote from one of Lewis's letters from 1949 in the collected letters, when someone asked him his doctrine, see whether or not there is an actual post-mortem conversion possible. And to this Lewis responded, quote, "I have no doctrine on such a purely speculative point. You must not confuse my romances," which romances is a more general term to his fiction, if you will, "with my thesis. In the latter, I state and argue a creed. In the former, such is merely supposed for the sake of the story."
If you've read Surprised by Hope by N.T. Wright, you've heard him talk about this. It's sort of relevant to end times, this idea that that what God is doing through redemption is redeeming all of creation and restoring beauty where there's ugliness and this sort of thing. And that's why we as Christians should pursue beauty through the arts, because we're sort of calling down heaven. Now, I don't think he would go so far as to say that, you know, we're just going to keep doing this and then one day we'll wake up and it'll be heaven. You know, God says that he's going to remake everything. There are other Christians that say, no, we need to abandon the arts. We need to just go hang out with poor people and just get down in their suffering and help them. Does C.S. Lewis address this dichotomy in any way? Does he address this calling down heaven? I mean, in his stories, Aslan never comes out of the wardrobe. They always go into the emperor's country. The bus goes up into heaven. Ransom goes to Perelandra. Is that an articulated question?
I think you're right that the characters do in fact leave, but the point of them leaving is not so that they can have an experience. The point of them leaving is so that they can be transformed and then take what they have learned, take the fruit of that transformation back to their immediate context, and then translate that to the exact place where they are. And so I think that message is, of those journeys is very much the journey of we go through these experiences for a purpose, for the edification of others, so that we can comfort with the comfort we've received, so that we can share the good news that we've now learned and internalized.
I'd like to say something, maybe addressing, if I understood what you were saying properly. In The Pilgrim's Regress, Lewis, of Father History, explains that the Jews were the only people that remembered how to read. In other words, the only people that still knew the law, and that was why they were almost obsessed with writing it down, with writing, because the only people that could read, they wrote and wrote and wrote. But everybody else, the pagans, the Gentiles, had forgotten how to read. But God, the landlord, did not desert them. He sent them pictures. And we live in an age now where the secular fundamentalists have forgotten how to read. They, in the sense that the relativism cannot engage on the level of reason. Therefore, it's difficult to engage relativists on the level of theology, because as soon as you mention God, they shut their ears. You can't engage them on the level of philosophy, because as soon as you mention truth, they say, in the words of Pilate, quid est veritas, no, but not what is truth as a question that needs to be answered, but what is truth? A rhetorical question by a cynic. There is no truth. So if you can't engage on the level of reason, the two levels you can still engage on are the levels that's the level of the true, and the level of the good, in other words, by becoming saints, by becoming holy, and the level of beauty. In other words, that we can still bring people to Christ through pictures. Now, whether those pictures are great art, great architecture, great music, or great stories, as C.S. Lewis told us, in a relativistic age which has forgotten how to think, we have to bring them to Christ in pictures.
I guess an analogy, too, to what you're asking, because one of the great things N.T. Wright has done is help revive heaven as a physical place. And by the way, there's an American doing it, too. Randy Alcorn wrote Heaven, and he spoke here. Was it last year or 2 years ago? Great, great book. But an analogy, because, you know, I've heard a few people say, oh, Lewis didn't talk much about the resurrection body. But in Miracles, he gives a wonderful analogy that I really love. And he talks about when children learn to ride ponies, it's not so when they grow up they can get rid of the ponies. It's so when they grow up they can ride mighty steeds, right? And Lewis talks about God giving us our body the same way. He doesn't give us our body so that some way we can throw it away. He gives it to us so that it will be perfected. And in that sense, all of these things will be perfected, but we have to let them die before they can be reborn. But he does talk about the resurrection, maybe not as much as I wish he had, but, you know, he does talk about it. It's there. It's pretty clear in Miracles particularly.
And, of course, you know, his best-known book, The Lion, the Witch, and Wardrobe, there is a reenactment of the death and resurrection of Christ as Lamb.
I'm reminded of the letter that Carl F. H. Henry, the editor of Christianity Today, writes to Lewis in September of 1955, asking for more theological articles. Lewis essentially writes theology and apologetics in the 40s and fiction in the 50s. It's, I think, a little ironic that the church gets the theology, the letters of Paul first, and then gets the narrative and story, in which we find in the gospel Jesus never opening his mouth without telling a parable, so that hearing they would not hear and seeing they would not see. And I think that Lewis has got this exactly in mind. I get frustrated by those who dismiss the fairy tales and who love the apologetics, and it's in when he does the fairy tales that he's, I think, really doing his work. He says to Carl Henry, "My thought and talent, such as they are," this is 1955, "now flow in different, though I think not less Christian channels, and I do not think I am at all likely to write more directly theological pieces. If I am now good for anything, it is for catching the reader unawares through fiction and symbol. I have done what I could in the way of frontal attacks, but I now feel quite sure those days are over." Catching the reader unawares through fiction and symbol was Lewis's mature graduate work once he was a professor. He did the pedantic work early, but the real lyricism, and that's where I think Michael Ward's argument about silence and secrecy and how Lewis might have been really cohesive and embedded and not out there blatantly saying it on the radio every week for 10 minutes in the simplest words he could. I think that the depth of Lewis's symbolism and imagery has only begun to be plumbed. If it took 50 years for us to figure out the Narnia code, and there's a lot of undiscovered country as well.
You know, what you just said, that letter is a great answer, because, you know, there's this sort of myth that when Lewis debated Anscombe and lost afterwards, he gave up on rational apologetics. But he says it right here. He wrote his rational apologetics. He's going to write, you know, what else is he going to write? He moved on to that. So that's actually a good answer, that letter you just read.
We learn the steps of the dance in order to dance. To me, those who love the apologetics and not the fairy tale love learning how to dance, but I'd rather a good hoedown than that. Or English country dance.
Thanks for listening to this first of a two-part podcast featuring the panel discussion from the 2012 C.S. Lewis Foundation Retreat. I'm William O'Flaherty, and this is All About Jack, which is a feature of my EssentialCSLewis.com website. All About Jack is also part of the Theology Mix podcast network. When you check the show notes, you will find links to websites or blogs of those who participated in the panel discussion, and also, if relevant, a link to a recent podcast where they were a guest on my show. The show notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast is most easily found and navigated. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. The other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, highlights the most recent show on the main page and also has space dedicated to listing past shows and the notes for them. Additionally, you can find a variety of other material on Lewis there, including a popular series that explores quotations attributed to him that may not be actually from him. Be sure to stop by my site to listen to other interviews and special podcasts on a variety of topics, mostly directly related to Lewis. In 2016, I shared an interview I did with Walter Hooper from when I made my first trip to England. Also be aware that I occasionally post previous released podcasts on my iTunes feed that can also be found at the Podbean address. If you don't know how to find the show on iTunes, then be sure to check the show notes for a direct link. Again, those notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllaboutJack.podbean.com. And if you do visit me via iTunes, please consider rating my podcast, as this can help others to find it. Finally, let me remind you, or in case you didn't know, I have a book out called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. It's available online at Amazon. The paperback is $14.99. And at last check, the Kindle version was just $5.49. Buying the book is a great way to help support my podcast. You can learn more about my book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Thanks again for listening to the All About Jack podcast.